On the show today, we talk labor strikes, shopping pitfalls, and how the rich gets richer. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Portland, Oregon, I'm Rima Reis in for Kai Rizdal. It is Monday, January 16th. Good to have you along. Today, of course, is a national holiday celebrating the legacy of Martin Luther King Jr. While the civil rights leader is known for his protests against segregation and racism, he was also an advocate of unions and workers' rights. In fact, in 1968, he was assassinated shortly after speaking with sanitation workers in Memphis. The workers were on strike to protest their low wages and unsafe working conditions. Union membership and strike activity has been falling in the decades since King's death. But more recently, that has been starting to change. Between 2021 and 2022, the number of strikes rose almost 50%. That's according to Cornell University. And as Marketplace's Justin Ho reports, that pickup in strike activity, it's got a lot of momentum.
In a lot of industries, working conditions have gotten a lot worse during the pandemic. Kathy Creighton at Cornell University says workers are stressed.
And with labor shortages, that exacerbates the stress because they're just, you know, you have to do more with a lot less people.
Creighton used to be an attorney with the National Labor Relations Board. And she says going on strike can be risky. In some cases, employers are allowed to permanently replace striking workers. But businesses might think twice about doing that right now, given how hard it's been to find workers in the first place.
If there's nobody in line to take your job because there are just not enough people, that gives you incredible strength in striking.
Creighton says many striking workers have won big concessions recently. Last week, nurses in New York City reached a deal to raise salaries by about 19% after striking for 3 days. But John Haywood, an economics professor at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, says employers have been pushing back. For instance, look at the more than 250 Starbucks locations that have voted to unionize.
There isn't one signed contract yet, and you can expect management to fight many, many of those.
And Haywood says the shortage of labor might not last if the economy slows and unemployment rises.
If it goes up a lot more, things would not look as favorable for labor.
Thing is, unions have been pushing back against growing income inequality, says Kate Bond, chief economist at the Washington Center for Equitable Growth. Even if labor shortages go away,
I think those sort of underlying structural factors that have driven workers to the breaking point remain really persistent.
And 71% of Americans approve of labor unions, according to Gallup. That's the highest approval rating since 1965.
By giving unions that are engaging in collective activity more leverage through public support of their activity, that puts more pressure on employers.
And Bond says as more strikes succeed, workers are more likely to organize one at their own workplaces. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
Markets were closed today because of the holiday, so we'll take a look at some other data when we do the numbers. All right, I've got three facts for you about wealth in this economy. Fact number one, about $42 trillion in new wealth has been created since the pandemic began. Fact number two, a big chunk of that wealth, two-thirds of it, has gone to the richest 1% of people. And fact number three, which should not be surprising given the two previous facts, in the U.S., billionaires are a third richer now than they were before the pandemic. These stats, by the way, come from a new report out today from the nonprofit Oxfam. To explain more, to help put those numbers in context, here's Marketplace's Samantha Fields.
It's no secret that it's a lot easier to make money when you already have money.
So much of what typical people in this country have is based on their income and what they make in the labor market.
Elise Gould at the Economic Policy Institute says that's not the case for the super wealthy.
Those at the very top are making kinds of investments because they have the money.
Investments in real estate, in companies, in the stock market, all of which have gained a huge amount of value in the pandemic, particularly in the first couple of years, says Molly Kinder at the Brookings Institution.
The stock market boomed through 2021. Companies did extremely well. They benefited from Fed policy, from low interest rates, from big government spending.
And when companies did extremely well, so did the very rich.
And that's because the bulk of stock in this country, of shares, are owned by the wealthiest households. Upwards of 70% of all stock is owned by just the top 5% of richest households.
But it's not just that the rich own a lot of stock and the stock market did well, Kinder says. It's also what many of the big companies that made the most money in the early days of the pandemic, companies like Amazon and Walmart, chose to do with those profits.
These companies spent five times more rewarding their shareholders through dividends and stock buybacks than they did raising pay for all of their workers.
Meanwhile, in many countries, inflation is now outpacing wages for most workers.
Hundreds of millions of people are unable to afford the cost of living.
Nabil Ahmed is at Oxfam America, which put out this report. He says extreme poverty is rising again around the world after falling for several decades.
At every turn, we're seeing inequality widen as a result of this pandemic.
But he says it's not inevitable.
It comes down to political and policy choices,
particularly around taxes and who pays what. In the US and many countries around the world, the richest people often pay a lower tax rate than the middle class. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
So a couple weeks ago, I was cooking dinner, and in the middle of it, I just stopped, dropped everything, because I remembered that this big online sale was about to end, and I really needed to buy a new rug. So I go on this website, and I see a countdown timer. I have about 4 minutes left before this sale ends. I don't have the time to pick out the perfect rug, so I just choose one, and I buy it with a few seconds to spare. And then I refresh this website, only to realize that this countdown timer was a complete sham. Had reset, and there were now 12 more hours left before the sale ended. These kinds of deceptive tactics have earned the name dark patterns. And Emily Stewart, who covers economics and business for Vox, recently wrote all about these marketing strategies when it comes to online shopping. Emily, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So I admittedly am a sucker when it comes to these marketing ploys. And I think the point of your article is that a lot of us are. So can you explain what are dark patterns exactly and what are some common examples?
Sure. So dark patterns are design tactics that companies use to push users in certain directions. Say when you sign up for a free trial and you don't notice that there's a box already checked that says you're going to renew at a charge, or there's a pop-up ad on a website. This happens to me all the time where I can't find that little X to close out the ad.
Same.
Yes. All the time. And so in online shopping, this appears in a lot of places, big and small. You know, you mentioned before countdown clocks, right? Where you get to check out and it says you have 10 more minutes. And it turns out a lot of the times you don't have 10 more minutes. You have a lot more time. You know, when you will see low stock count saying that a certain number of hotel rooms or shoes, whatever you're buying, are only available and they're going to run out.
So sometimes that's false.
Yes, sometimes that's false. Sometimes a lot of this stuff is false. I think that is the headline here, right? Is that, I mean, I fall for this stuff all of the time, but most of the time there very well are not three people looking at the same, you know, vacation package as you. So there are all sorts of ways that basically companies and sellers use to kind of make us feel that there's a sense of urgency, that there's a sense of scarcity around the things that we want to buy in an attempt to get us to buy more and faster.
Totally. Well, yeah, that leads me into my next question, which you sort of answered, which is, yeah, why are these tactics so powerful? What is it about them that really plays into our human instincts?
So these kind of get into our cognitive biases or tendencies in our thinking that don't exactly add up with logic or objective reasoning. So basically, these tactics kind of play into our own fears and the ways that we think. When we feel like something is scarce, when we feel like something is going to run out, when we feel like something is urgent. Another one in this category is social proof. So we tend to trust if other people have done this, if other people have bought this thing, if people we know like this thing, we trust other people's opinions. You know, we also like to feel like we're getting a deal, that we are getting some real value. There's a reason that Amazon Prime Day is very effective. Even if you're not necessarily getting the best price on Amazon Prime Day, there might be another day when an item is actually cheaper. But we like to feel like we're getting a deal, and like we're getting a deal that might run out. That makes us nervous, and so we buy.
Mm-hmm. Man, the review thing is so real. The other day I was trying to buy a shoe rack, and I really liked this one shoe rack, but it only had 3 reviews. And I was like, nope, not buying it. And so the big question now, how are online retailers able to get away with this?
I mean, every expert I spoke to for the recent story that I did on this basically said there is not a whole lot being done. You know, one person I talked to said, listen, the FTC is supposed to be looking at this stuff. The FTC says it's looking at this stuff, but they have limited resources. And a lot of people I talked to said, you know, the risk is low here. And if you do get caught, maybe you'll get slapped with a fine. But if you're making a bunch of money by making people think that there are only 2 hotel rooms left, there's plenty of incentive to use these sorts of tactics, and companies do. I mean, I was shocked when reporting for this and looking at the different tools that are available, that the companies that create these tools are pretty open, that the low stock counter can be real or created inventory, as in you can make it up.
Wow. That surprised me the most. But like, surely there are some lines they can't cross, right?
Yeah. I mean, one person told me, and this is, I think, a funny quote, fake pricing is illegal most places. Fake scarcity is not very illegal. You know, I obviously can't make up prices, but it's a fine line here in terms of what's allowed and what's not. And like I said before, a lot of it is who's really enforcing this stuff? What agency has the time to go and track a lot of this information down?
So, okay. So then it sounds like it really is on the consumer to be more careful rather than, you know, the business being more ethical. So with that reality, what are some strategies and tips for how we as consumers can be more mindful of these so-called dark patterns?
I think the first thing to note here is that this stuff is hard. Most people don't have time. When you're online shopping, you're not sitting there thinking, if every little trick or little design thing on the website is meant to make you buy more or buy something quicker, right? So I think number one is that it is difficult and it is easy to forget. That being said, you know, just like you shouldn't go to the grocery store hungry, you shouldn't shop online when you're in a really big hurry. If you have the time, you know, put something in your cart, let it sit there for a day, decide if you still need it or if you still want it. One person I talked to said, you know, and this seems really obvious, but he was like, don't shop drunk. He said, you'd be shocked at how many people do a lot of e-commerce shopping on Friday and Saturday nights because they get home from the bar and they want to buy some things. And so I do think that there is a sense of, you know, you want to really do your homework if you can. But I do think kind of ultimately here, the thing about these tricks is that they work. If they didn't, marketers wouldn't use them. And there's only so much you can do. I will most certainly fall for the scarcity thing and the low stock count until the day that I die.
I mean, same. But basically, you're saying we should just chill, which I will try to do next time when I need to buy a rug. Emily Stewart, she covers economics and business for Vox. Emily, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up,
to grate this amount of cheese, it would take approximately a day for one person. So it's quite a lengthy process.
Challenge accepted. But first, let's do the numbers. Again, markets in the U.S. are closed today for the Martin Luther King Jr. holiday, but we've got some other numbers for you all. Last month, U.S. consumers finally got a bit of relief from inflation. It wasn't much. Consumer prices fell 0.1% from November, but it was the first monthly decrease since May 2020. Gas prices fell 9.4%. Used cars were down 2.5%. But one area where prices remained stubbornly high was food. Digging into that a bit more, one subcategory that saw huge increases was for school breakfasts and lunches, which rose a shocking 305% over last year. Part of that is, of course, ingredients are more expensive, but another key reason was the end of a pandemic-era federal program that made school meals free, regardless of students' income levels. Now some states like Washington, Minnesota, Vermont are trying to make up that shortfall with state funds. You're listening to Marketplace. Hey everyone, it's Rima Khreis, host of This is Uncomfortable. If you're looking for some good recommendations on books to read, well, you should join This is Uncomfortable's Summer Book Club. Every other week in our newsletter, we'll share a new book that'll make you rethink your relationship to money, class, and work, while also featuring an interview with the author or an expert on the topic. Plus, when you join, you'll be entered in a giveaway where you could win some This is Uncomfortable merch. Be sure to check it out. Sign up today at marketplace.org/bookclub. This is Marketplace. I'm Rima Khreis. So we talked earlier about online shopping, and now we are going to pivot to brick and mortar stores, in particular gift, novelty, and souvenir shops, which latest numbers tell us they raked in about $19 billion in sales back in 2021. Now, with a lot of these shops, the challenge is how do you stand out from the rest? Well, one way is by simply selling things you're not going to find anywhere else. And that brings us to today's installment of our series, My Economy.
My name is Rico Llanat Wirl. I am Tlingit and Athabascan from Juneau, Alaska, and I run a business called Trickster Company, where I integrate my indigenous identity into products that range from playing cards to skateboards to snowboards to apparel to jewelry and all kinds of other things. There's a very big market for knockoff native art. As soon as people get off the cruise ships, they just see lots of it everywhere. And we're kind of breaching into that market and making space for ourselves in our own market, ironically. One thing that I've always seen at a lot of these shops is playing cards. They're, you know, something small that people can buy and bring home. Even I, as a kid, you know, playing cards with my cousins would have some that had native art on it. But then you'd always flip it over and just have the basic, like, kings and queens of Europe on the back, which was kind of a, you know, juxtaposition. So I really wanted to make a deck of playing cards for the next generation that wants to like play cards and have their own people represented on them. But the challenge was that I couldn't afford a run of thousands of products right from the start. So I ended up running a Kickstarter, and that was actually really successful. I got to the goal and then I doubled it. And so with the second goal, I actually made a second deck of playing cards that had the Tlingit words for the numbers to kind of promote language learning as well. The interesting thing is that that deck still outsells the standard deck to this day. There's a long history of native art being appropriated in the wrong way, to the point where a lot of people even just say, okay, no more native art being associated with commercial things. But for me, I've always felt like people want to celebrate native art. Like if you go to museums in any part of the world, you'll see Pacific Northwest Coast art. So people want to celebrate it. We just need to give them the opportunity to do it in an appropriate way. And so anything that we design for Trickster Company and sell through Trickster Company is designed so that anybody can appreciate it and wear it. One thing that I like to say about my art is that it's a living art form. And so it's an art form that evolves from every generation to the next. And, you know, as a modern Indigenous artist, I am raised in the traditional style, but it doesn't mean I'm excluded from modern lifestyles and modern art forms. I think the moments that I feel the most pride are the simplest. For example, when I'm just in my car driving through town and I see a young kid walking down the street with a Trickster Company basketball, just like, you know, enjoying their day. That's the moment when my goal of having Native identity be so accessible in a day-to-day situation that it's just the moments I feel the most proud.
That was Rico Wuerl of Trickster Company up in Juneau, Alaska. Now, we can't do this series without you, so let us know what's going on in your economy over at marketplace.org/myeconomy. Now, a story about cheese. Specifically, Stilton cheese. That is an English blue cheese that's been made since the 1700s and has protected status, meaning it can only be made in three places in England. But with soaring production costs and manufacturers in the U.S. and around the world wanting to make cheaper versions of it, traditional cheesemakers are warning that the future of Stilton cheese may be under threat. The BBC's Katie Barnfield explains.
Nestled among farmers' fields in the English county of Leicestershire is Longclawson Dairy. They've been making Stilton since 1912. Nowadays, it's a big operation.
This fantastic dairy here produces about 65% of all the Stilton that is sold worldwide.
Managing Director Bill Matheson explains that despite making 5,000 tonnes of Stilton a year, the dairy has to stick to techniques passed down through generations.
Has got protected designation of origin. We have to make Stilton under a very prescribed way of making it. When you talk about that status, things that would be akin to that, which in other markets might be Roquefort cheese, in terms of from France, or Parma ham.
Master cheesemaker Steve Smith takes me through the process, much of which is still done by hand.
We'll hand salt a block of curd, which is then mixed together and then hand placed into one of our cylindrical hoops. So the product then comes into our hastener, which is where we turn the cheese, because all of the salt and all of the whey would just drain to one end if we left it alone. On the first day, we'll turn it three times, and then we'll turn it just once a day.
But keeping to tradition like this makes it hard to cut costs. And Bill tells me soaring inflation is now threatening the future of this historic product.
We've seen inflation, when you're looking in the UK, of inflation being at 10%. We've had inflation in our business of over 40%.
That's because of things like rising energy bills and the price of milk, which they get from farms within a 30-mile radius, almost doubling. Labour costs are also high, as the process demands skilled workers. Steve says each cheese has to be individually tested and scored on its flavour and aroma, a process called grading.
I have a grading iron in my hand.
Looks like a pretty long apple corer.
It's like an apple corer, yes, exactly that. Push that into the cheese. I'm then looking for the blue veining from the centre of the cheese all the way up to the crust. It takes quite a long time to become a master grader. To grade this amount of cheese, it would take approximately a day for one person, so it's quite a lengthy process.
Around the world, demand for this traditional product is high.
The US represents the largest export market for British and European cheese. Our cheese market is about a $35 billion a year market.
Liz Thorpe is an international cheese expert and consultant. She explains that in some ways, Stilton is a victim of its own success, with producers in countries like the US keen to copy it. And now Britain has left the EU, its protected status no longer has the same enforcement.
There is an entire division of the European government that is responsible for sort of monitoring the protection of these various names. When the UK exited, you have your own name protection, but there's no one who's monitoring and enforcing that on your behalf.
For Bill Matheson and his team at Longclawson, the future is uncertain.
Of the producers that were out there, there were seven, and we're now down to six. If we don't see support for Stilton, there'll be other casualties.
But despite their fears for the future, they hope the appeal of this traditional cheese will be enough to preserve it for another 300 years. I'm the BBC's Katie Barnfield, reporting for Marketplace.
this final note on the way out today. We start off the show with Justin talking about the rise we're seeing in union membership and strike activity. We're seeing it in a lot of sectors, among nurses, warehouse employees, teachers, and now physicians in training. An article in the Wall Street Journal today talks about how medical residents across the country are demanding higher pay and better working conditions, especially after dealing with all the demands from the pandemic. The Committee of Interns and Residents, which is the largest group representing doctors in residency and fellowship programs, says it added chapters at 5 teaching hospitals last year. The rate before the pandemic was roughly 1 new chapter per year. The group says it'll only vote to strike as a last resort. The last time one of its unions actually went on strike was back in 1981. All right, we're about to go, but not before your moment of economic context. This one comes to us from Business Insider. It's about how the layoffs in tech are not slowing down. On average, at least 1,600 tech workers have been laid off every day of 2023 so far. As we've reported on this show, tech companies like Amazon, Meta, Salesforce started handing out those pink slips late last year. That is after they aggressively hired and expanded during the pandemic, but are now realizing, oh, whoops, maybe we were a little too optimistic. Our daily production team includes Andy Corbin, Richard Cunningham, Nicholas Guiyong, Maria Hollenhorst, Sarah Leeson, Sean McHenry, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Rima Jerez, and we'll be back tomorrow. This is APM. Hey everyone, it's Rima Jerez, host of This Is Uncomfortable. If you're looking for some good recommendations on books to read, well, you should join This Is Uncomfortable's Summer Book Club. Every other week in our newsletter, we'll share a new book that'll make you rethink your relationship to money, class, and work, while also featuring an interview with the author or an expert on the topic. Plus, when you join, you'll be entered in a giveaway where you could win some This Is Uncomfortable merch. Be sure to check it out. Sign up today at marketplace.org/bookclub.